Welcome to the Negotiations Ninja podcast, where we develop and deliver the most engaging negotiation content and training in the world. We host negotiation experts, business people, and entrepreneurs, and discuss what works, what doesn't work, and how we can improve our negotiation skills. Hello, Negotiations Ninja listeners. Welcome to the Negotiations Ninja podcast. We're throwing back all the way to episode 47. Can you believe it? My goodness, that's a long time ago. To a conversation that I had with Michael Wheeler. He's a professor at the Harvard Business School, and we talk all about improvisation in negotiation, of which I think he is fantastic at teaching. He likens it to jazz, actually. It's a great conversation that we have. Enjoy. Mike Wheeler, how are you?
I'm excellent. I can tell you why if you're curious, Mark.
I would love to know.
Yesterday, I was on campus at Harvard. Traffic in Boston has gotten awful. It took me the better part, or I should say the worst part, of 2 hours to get home. I'm working at home today, so the digital revolution has spared me a lot of aggravation and traffic, and my feet are up on the desk, the window's open, I can sometimes hear boats go by, so I'm a happy guy.
Fantastic. You get to avoid all the traffic today.
Indeed.
Awesome. For those people that don't know much about you, Mike, and your history, maybe you can give us some personal background, how you got started at Harvard, and what it is you do at the Program on Negotiation.
Well, let me give you an abbreviated form, because it's been a long, strange trip. But when I was in law school in a law public policy program, I had the great good luck of having been taught by Jim White, who was visiting from Michigan, and he was a pioneering teacher of negotiation. So we would do simulations in that course that are still a common mode of teaching. But there wasn't a great deal of theory in it. The same semester, I was taking a public policy course taught jointly by law school faculty, including Supreme Court Justice Steve Breyer, and Kennedy School of Government faculty, including Tom Schelling, who later won the Nobel Prize. And it didn't take a genius to see that the decision theory and game theory that we were learning in that policy course tracked very nicely to negotiation. And I was off and running after that. Taught negotiation in different kinds of professional schools. I was at MIT for a good time and a good long time nonetheless. 25 years or so I've been at the Harvard Business School teaching negotiation and MBA program and also in a series of executive programs.
Awesome. That's really, really cool. You know what? I think the one thing that strikes me as interesting about your background is that you delve into topics, especially on the research side, that a lot of people don't talk about because it almost seems like it's too difficult for some people to talk about, and that's improvisation in negotiations, because there's a certain amount of improvisation that we all have to do in negotiations. And I mean, let's talk about the subtitle of your book. The subtitle of your book is How to Improvise Agreement in a Chaotic World. What do you mean by that, and how much of an active role does improvisation take in negotiations?
So I think it's the heart of negotiation. And when people kind of raise their eyebrows to that, I say, okay, imagine you've got a negotiation coming up next week. What's the fifth thing you're going to say? And of course, they don't have an answer, because it's all going to depend on how they're reading the person across the table, whether they're in sales or procurement or whatever. Is this a person who takes a collaborative approach, or are they more contentious? So there's somebody else's hands on the wheel, and you've got to get down the highway figuring out, you know, what road you want to take. So in a broad sense, we have to improvise depending on whom we're dealing with and what the situation is. I'm skeptical of one-size-fits-all strategies. There are plenty of opportunities to be creative and in negotiation and to build relationships. There are other times where you're going toe-to-toe. And the notion that you can just read Getting to Yes, written by my friends and colleagues, terrific book and so forth, or you can read Hardball stuff to start with No and so forth. I think there's truth in both of those books and the ones that have come out of them, but you've got to be more nimble strategically, and you also have to be quick on your feet. I think that's a given, and I think any experienced negotiator would agree with that. But you can correct me if I'm wrong, Mark, but I don't think that other books actually figure out how you don't just wing it, how it sounds like a contradiction, but how you plan to improvise. And that's the topic that I've tackled of late. If you think about it, there are plenty of other people, there are plenty of other fields in which people improvise. Jazz, I talk about in my book, The Art of Negotiation, improv comedy. The rules don't necessarily track one-to-one, but we can learn from experts in both those fields. You think about medical diagnosis, where there's testing, there is kind of calibrating what a particular patient has. I've learned a lot from my students who have military experience, and there's a lot in military doctrine which, instead of being rigid and fixed, and has to be very fluid. It's the fog of negotiation, just the way it is the fog of war. So I've done my best to learn from people who are adept at improvising in those settings and see what we can learn from them to apply to negotiation.
Very interesting. And so how do we prepare ourselves to be able to improvise? You mentioned medical diagnostics, and I love that analogy, because you get to test a theory, and then if the theory doesn't work, you take a different tact. And so maybe you can draw some comparisons between those two and how we can prepare ourselves to be able to improvise in the heat of the moment.
Well, there was a study at Mass General Hospital of young MDs who were in training to be specialists in anesthesia. And the researcher, Jenny Rudolph, looked very carefully at how they would approach a case. And instead of using real people, they have these things that are sort of mannequins, robots that have all the vital signs of respiration, blood pressure, and lots of other metrics. And they're presented with this device that's in a bed. They're given the history. And the story is that this person has had a burst appendix. They were given some sort of anesthesia, and now they're having dire problems breathing. What do you do? 39 people in the sample, two of them couldn't figure out how to get started. They were just completely flummoxed. So patient dies in that case, the artificial patient. The next group, about a third of the remaining 37, came up with a very plausible diagnosis, the most likely thing. But then as the conditions got worse, they didn't revise their diagnosis. They were married to it. And as a consequence, they were blind to all the signs that this was actually making things worse. Patient dies. Third situation, people come with that same initial diagnosis. They see it isn't working. They try something else, but they're just hopping around. And Jenny calls those diagnostic vagabonds. They die. So we get to the last group, and these are the group. This is what we want to be when we negotiate. These are adaptive learners. So they come up with the first diagnosis. They see it isn't working. They step back and say, okay, what was I getting distracted by? What was I missing? What's the most dangerous thing that I could do here? I don't want to make it worse. And so as a consequence, they learn from their mistakes, and they are ready to challenge their own assumptions. So instead of saying this patient has X, they say this patient might have X, but maybe it's Y. And if it's Y, I certainly don't want to make things worse. So how do we apply that to negotiation? I think what we have to do is we have to look at, with somebody mowing outside here or haying or something, I don't know what's going on. Let me close the window. Does that help a little bit?
Yeah, you're good.
Okay, well, it's going to be like a sauna in here before too long, but I can cope. So in negotiation, I think we've got to have an aspiration. We've got to have a target. What's the best case scenario? Not fantasy land, but if the stars really are well aligned for me, how much room is there for agreement, and how can I capture a lot of value here? A lot of people go into negotiation with that attitude. You also just say, okay, worst case scenario, what could make this really hard to do? Why might I be in a weaker position than I am? What do I need to do to protect myself in that instance? And in fact, that's how Marines are trained. They often are kind of a first contact with hostile forces. They have little time to plan. But there are two watchwords. One is, what's the most likely thing to happen? And second, what's the most dangerous thing that could happen? Well, those are questions that we ought to ask ourselves in negotiation. And thinking about that last precept, if we're going in to make a sale, you know, we hope they respect the service or product that we're selling. We hope they see the value proposition and all that sort of thing. But we have to be mindful that maybe they don't get it, or maybe we've got a competitor who is going to drastically give them a discount in order to pull their business from us. What are we going to do in that instance? So does that cover all the possibilities? No, but it covers the two most important ones. What's the most likely thing to happen? What's the most dangerous thing to happen? What's the best case scenario? What's the worst? And I think going through that process puts us in a frame of mind that when we get to the table, we're telling ourselves, I don't have perfect vision. There are things I may be missing. What do I need to ask? What do I need to test? And good negotiators, I think, bring that attitude to the table. The rest of us, I think, can learn to do it.
That's very interesting. And do you find that, based on your research, do most people who negotiate fall into a particular group? You mentioned the different groups in the medical diagnostic tests, some people getting married to a diagnosis and some people aren't. Do the majority of us fall into a particular group?
So the answer is a qualified yes. And if people can kind of lean in, I'm going to explain something. After the book was published, I developed an app, Negotiation 360. It's in iOS, it's on Android. But basically, it boils down to this. It asks you, Mark, to rate your relative strength at four important skills. On the problem-solving dimension, that would be creating value, expanding the pie on one hand, versus getting a decent or maybe even an indecent slice of that pie. On a different axis, the relational, how do you rate yourself in terms of understanding where other people are coming from, empathizing with their feelings? And on the other side of that, how good are you at asserting your interest, making your case? And when I ask people to do this, not are you excellent at that, are you lousy at it, but if you have 16 points to apply to those four skills, maybe you'd go 4-4-4-4, I'm equally good in all of that. Very few people say that. Most people think they're tilted in one direction or another in terms of the relationship dimension, empathizing, asserting, or the problem solving, creating, and claiming. And looking at more than 1,000 people, to get to your question, I found that people fall into five buckets, and there's no dominant bucket. There are the, if you will, empathetic value creators. And it sort of makes sense. If you're good or think you're good at reading other people and engaging them, then that ought to lead to a productive discussion that creates value. But you also may feel when I do that, I kind of expose my interest myself and people may take advantage of it. I don't push hard, so maybe I'm not as assertive as I ought to be. That's the biggest group, and that's about 30%. There are other people who say, you know, I can make the case for myself. I can be forceful. I probably stress some relationships, so I mark myself down in terms of the empathy and assertiveness, but I get a goodly share of the pie. So those are the assertive value claimers. There are three other types. It's a lot easier to see this visually than it is for me to describe it. But there are people who are more relationally oriented, people who are more problem-solving. There are also some assertive value creators. Now, this is all self-perception, and we know there's risk in that. And what the app tries to do is to capture feedback you get from other people so you can calibrate and say, I thought I was good at this. It turns out I'm very good at this. Or I thought I was good at this. My friends tell me I'm not so hot. So I'm very interested in that typology. I think the best negotiators are truly nimble Depending on the situation, depending on whom they're dealing with, they can be tough and firm when they need to be. They can be open and engaging in other cases. It's flexibility that fits the situation and fits the person. I wouldn't want to be locked into any one of those boxes. I'd hope I would have the ability to stretch and grow so I can adapt to the situation.
Interesting. You know what? We were chatting about this a little bit earlier, but one of the things that we struggle with in negotiation and getting better at negotiation is feedback, because we really only have the result after the fact to know whether or not we did okay. Like, did we go in, execute our plan, and did we get what we executed? So getting that feedback and having a consistent feedback loop is a struggle, because most of the time we just don't get that.
So it's important that you picked up on that, Mark. If you're playing basketball, if you're working on your serve in tennis, the ball goes in the hoop, or it goes across the net if it's tennis or whatever. If it's just where it ought to be, don't change a thing. If we stay with the basketball example, if you hit the rim and it clanks out, maybe a little more arc, maybe a little more knee bend and so forth. How about negotiation? You've prepared well, you know the market, you've read the contract proposal carefully. You go and negotiate, you come back empty-handed, no deal. What lesson do you draw from that? There are a number of possibilities. One is, it may be that there was no way that the best you could do was going to be good enough for them. There simply was no room for agreement. Another possibility is that you pushed too hard. There was a deal there, but you annoyed the other party, and they said, forget him. You know, I'm going to go deal with somebody else. Or maybe they were the ones who were unreasonable, and they walked away from a proposal that you made where actually it was in their interest and they just couldn't see it. So I think it's really hard judging the result. I mean, you come back and you, quote, you really did well. You got even more than you hoped. Well, good for you. But maybe you were dealing with somebody who made a mistake. Maybe they were under more pressure than you anticipated. Maybe you could have gotten even more. So I think instead of looking at the result, and we care about the result clearly, I just don't think it teaches us much. Instead of just looking at the result, I think we have to look what we put into it. So people are getting better at preparing. I don't think most people are very good at after-action review. So if you've written up some notes and say, here's my target deal, here's what I'm shooting for, here's what I need to say and do, here's what I need to see to achieve that goal. Here's my floor, right? Here's a line I'm going to draw. I might adjust it, you know, in the course of negotiation, but here's my floor. And here are some bullet points on strategy. You do that, that's going to be helpful. But when you're done, you should go back to your notes and say, okay, where do I pat myself on the back? What did I correctly foresee? Two, what did I overlook? What could I have done better? So what worked well? What would you do differently? Over time, you can build a library of best practices that's tailored to your particular skill set, that builds on what you do well and makes you put your effort on those things where the reward for improvement is going to be greatest. And I think the payoff for that after-action review, a little bit of time, I think can yield great dividends. And again, I'm shamelessly pitching the app, but that's what the app is about, is to prompt us to learn the right lessons from our experience.
Yeah, and I, you know what, I tend to agree with you. I think one thing that we really drop the ball on as, you know, salespeople or procurement people, professional negotiators in general, is that we don't do a lot of post-engagement analysis. You know, and I mean, we see it all the time in sports. We see it in the military. They do a great job of breaking down what worked well, what didn't work well, what can we do better next time.
But why do you think it is, Mark? I'm just curious.
Why do I think the other people do it well and we don't?
Yeah, and we don't. I mean,
you know, I think there's a certain,
so important in other kinds of things.
Mike, I think a lot of salespeople and procurement people are arrogant to a large extent. You know, we we come in with a certain amount of arrogance, and I think our, you know, a lot of our industries breed. It sounds like a terrible thing to say, but I think it breeds that overconfidence where we come in, we close a deal, and you know, just because we close the deal, we think we got a good deal. You know, we got a deal, and that's what we're celebrating. But we're not celebrating the quality of that deal, or we're not determining whether or not that deal was quality to begin with. And so
you,
I
you talked about the arrogance. I remember this was some years ago, time to get a new car, and I knew what I wanted, and I knew the market a little bit, and given the nature of my calling, I've got to either put up or shut up, right? I've got to be able to do this well. And I was looking at a particular vehicle. It was 10 minutes of 8. The showroom was about to close, and I was getting a high-pressure treatment from the salesman. I could actually have lived okay with the price he was talking about. I thought we could shave a little bit. But he was being such a pain. You know, I said, let me sleep on this. He said, you know, somebody else could come and snap it up. And I said, yeah, probably not in the next 9 minutes before you close. I said that to myself, but not to him. And as I drove home, he was such an idiot. I just didn't want to give him the business.
Yeah.
So I never went back. Now, if you think about it, he might have thought I was just a tire kicker. I was ready to buy. But if he hadn't been such an idiot, I would have closed the deal that evening. He gets no input on that. Now, he remembers the time where he got somebody to pay list or even more for a car that he was desperate to unload. And he gets that feedback, and it reinforces the confidence that you talked about there. Now, I can diagnose that in the car salesman. I think it's really tricky to see it when you look in the mirror. You know, what am I overlooking here? If you don't even go through the routine of an after-action review, I think you're missing a great opportunity. So you and I totally are aligned on that.
Totally agree with you. I think it takes a certain amount of humility to be able to, you know, stop at the end of the deal and go, okay, did I actually get something that I wanted here? You know, did I do everything that I needed to do? Did I execute on everything that I wanted to execute on? But you know what, that we don't get taught that, especially not in sales. You know, it's drive for the close and that's it.
So amp it up. So we've been talking about the individual. Another kind of ignored area in negotiation is thinking about it systemically. And I've had some colleagues working here. Here's what I mean by systemically. There's a sales manager, and I come back and I haven't made the sale. Well, that's a ding against me. You know, I may have, you know, depending on whether you have accelerators and commissions and that sort of thing. So there's a great deal of pressure for me to close a deal. I think a lot of companies make mistakes by not applauding when their salespeople or procurement people sometimes come home and say, there wasn't a deal here. You know, I remember doing some consulting, but won't mention names here, for a mid-sized company. And I was with the CEO and some of the senior people in the firm. And he said, we pride ourselves in 20 years, we've never failed to close a deal. And when I met with them privately, I didn't want to say this in front of the people who worked for him. I said, that's a strange thing to be proud of, that you've never closed a deal. He said, why? I said, well, there are two possibilities here. One is you're saying yes to things you shouldn't say yes to just for the sake of reaching agreement.
Right.
You ought to go after some deals where it's not a sure thing. If you could pull it off, great, you know, but it's not a sure thing. It's going to be hard. Or it means that you're just going after the low-hanging fruit. So from a company point of view, I were in charge of a team of salespeople, I'd want to be sure that they understood that we have limits. There's so much that we can do. And when you come back empty handed, good, go get the next one.
Isn't that interesting? You know what? I love that. I love the fact that you've identified where there might be flaws in the closing methodology, because so often we consider closing to be the be all end all of the negotiation, and that's not necessarily true. Either you're leaving money on the table, or you're potentially not swinging for the fences.
The other thing, too, is the incentives have to be set up right. I did some work with a very successful company that's a magazine publisher, and they at that time had five what they call books. You and I would call them magazines, and my hunch is that many of our listeners subscribe or at least pick up the newsstand, one or more of those magazines. And they were frustrated because they felt that their salespeople were being inconsistent in their behavior in terms of the deals that they were getting. Some were getting good deals, some not so good. I said, well, I'm talking to senior vice presidents for sales for these five different books, as they call them, magazines. I said, well, tell me a deal that works. It turns out there's for advertising space in magazines, it depends. Is this going to run once? Is it going to run every month? Is it for color? Is it the front of the book? Is it next to related editorial content? How far away it is from the competitors? So there's a lot of stuff beyond the rate card that gets negotiated. So give me an example of a deal that you could live with. Not a home run deal, but a deal where, yeah, we'd say yes to that. One guy spoke up and said, you know, here's something to be yesable, but barely. Somebody else said, we never would accept that. Now think about the salespeople who are out there in the field. Depending on whom you're working for on that given day, you get a thumbs up from one and a different digit on another. And another thing, they were frustrated because people weren't cross-selling. I've landed a deal with a car manufacturer for my magazine, Magazine A. Mark, I had to help you out, and so you can get them in Magazine B that you're doing sales for.
Right.
Well, that would be nice for the organization as a whole. I, as the salesman for Magazine A, didn't get anything for that. And I'm not saying that money is everything or badges is everything, but if I'm working my rear end off to close the deal from my Magazine A, I'm supposed to be a good guy and sell them on Magazine B, which is your territory, and that's your P&L, and they couldn't see that. So every organization has a negotiation system. It determines how people are rewarded, whether there are commissions or targets. It sometimes sets a baseline rate card or something of that sort. There are bonus systems. There's also how much discretion do you have to be creative? You know, and we love creativity in negotiation, but we also have to be semi-consistent case to case. But if people out in the field have no guidance on where the boundaries are, you're not operating at maximum efficiency. So that's the end of my sermon on that.
I think you're absolutely correct. You know, one of the things that you write about in your book is talking about maintaining emotional balance. And I think this ties really well into the improvisation discussion because, you know, there's a lot of negotiation texts out there that will assume rationality. They'll assume that the other party that you're dealing with is a rational party, they're logical, and you can have a normal conversation about this, and then you can eventually drive for value and so on. But in business, it could be all over the place. You might be dealing with someone that has a massive inferiority complex, and they get very emotionally attached to closing a deal a certain way or winning something, and you talk about maintaining your emotional balance and staying alert. I wonder if you could dive into how people could maintain their emotional balance better and be better prepared to be emotionally drawn into the negotiation. Because what I find is that so often we get pulled in with our emotions. Someone's able to draw us in or hit our hot buttons.
Yep.
And we
Yep.
lose track of what it is we're negotiating, and eventually we're emotionally tied into it. How do we maintain that emotional balance?
So step one is that with a colleague and friend of mine, Kim Leary, we've looked deeply at the emotional baggage that people bring to the table, and we've worked with a sample of people who were experienced negotiators. And even they had, in varying degrees, anxieties about negotiations, some quite deep, as a matter of fact, others less so. And the anxiety, in some respect, comes when it matters, right? We've got some stakes here. We're trying to achieve something, and whether it's a financial deal, a partnership, we're trying to build a relationship with somebody. It's not entirely in our control. We love things that we can control, but there's somebody across the table who may be as smart as we are, as anxious as we are, as defensive or suspicious as we might be on a given day. And they may not want to play the game that we want to play the game. So that's the reality of it. And it's understandable that it can raise some level of anxiety. I think let's start with ourselves on this. We go back to the sports metaphor. The best athletes are those who summon their best in the high tense moments. You know, we had Big Papi here in Boston, a great clutch hitter. He loved it. There are other people who can perform fine in a meaningless regular season game, and they choke when everything is on the table. Same thing can happen in negotiation. So I have in the Art of Negotiation book six steps that I think people ought to think about before they negotiate, and I'll give them to you quickly here. One, what do you want to feel going into negotiation? I'll come back to each one of these. Two, how do you get in that state? Three, what can throw you off in the course of negotiation? And I'm here, I'm counting on my fingers, I may have dropped one out. How do you recover your footing when you're thrown off your game? And we'll call them five steps here. What do you want to feel when you're done? So for many people, the idea that you have any control over that is novel, but you do, right? So let's say you're in the midst of a negotiation that's going back and forth. Your counterpart calls you, or you're in the middle of something else. There's every temptation at that moment to pick up the conversation again. If this is important, I would say, can I call you back in 3 minutes? And try to clear your desk and try to clear your mind so you're focused and you're centered as opposed to just jumping into it. And when I ask people, what do they want to feel going into negotiation? People want to say, I want to be calm. I want to be relaxed. And in a class, somebody else, yeah, that's good. But I want to be alert. I want to be on my game. I want to be engaged. So part of the trick is being both, not a little alert and a little bit relaxed, but pulling those both up. And for some people, it's taking a pause moment, as I talked about. Some of my HBS students, executive and MBAs, do some meditation. What's your soundtrack? What do you want to listen to before you go into the negotiation? I said at the beginning of this conversation, I'm having a good day because I didn't have to deal with Boston traffic, you know? Man, going into a negotiation where you're late to arrive, you know, you might as well carry a couple cinder blocks with you. That's real heavy baggage. So I'm not going to go through all those other steps. But to some degree, if we think about preparation as entailing not just the research we do and reviewing our notes and so forth, but getting centered, man, that's all upside.
I love that. You know, so often we think about the strategy as, you know, what are we going in to get? What are our low-end range, our high-end range? How are we going to negotiate in that gray area? But we don't often think about the emotional side of the negotiation and how we may feel during that negotiation and what our hot button issues are. There's a certain amount of self-awareness, I think, that comes with that, obviously. If you're going to leave the listeners with a couple of tips that you feel that everyone should know about negotiation, what would they be?
Well, tip number one is there's always more to learn. And I speak from having a long and lucky life in that regard. But whether it's from the books that you talked about or listening to colleagues, in my case, my students, I'm sure you've got people who are very effective negotiators who listen to your podcast. But there's always room for improvement. If when you prepare your strategy, you can find somebody to be a coach, be a buddy. Okay, here's the way I'm seeing the situation. Sometimes that coach will tell you, I think that sounds good. But somebody, have you thought about this? Right? You know, what if you did that? What if they're thinking this? So we can all use coaching. It, you know, actors have directors, athletes have coaches, and so forth. Physicians have mentors. Find a mentor and find a buddy where you can coach him or her and vice versa. That's tip number one. Tip number two is you don't have to get 100 times better. You don't have to get 10 times better. Even a modest improvement in negotiation skill can have a disproportionate impact, positive impact. It can be the difference between making a deal or having a deal slip through your fingers. It can be the difference of making an okay deal or making a creative one. And we've been talking about transactional negotiation. When you get better at negotiation, you're going to be better at putting out small fires, little disputes, small haggles, and so forth, and building a better relationship than if you don't make that improvement. So we don't have to have, you know, superhuman capacities here. If we can see this as a process of continual improvement, you'll be more effective, and frankly, life becomes more interesting.
I love it. That's great advice. Mike, if people want to follow your work and find out more about what you're doing, not only with the app, but maybe with some other things that you've got on the go, how do they do that?
So a couple of things, part of which I'd like to share what I've learned. Part of it is I get great feedback from people. But one, I've mentioned the app. You can find it in the App Store and in Google Play, the Negotiation 360 app. It'll set you back $5 or something like that. But it is intended to give people some discipline about learning from their experience and building a repertoire of best practices. Second thing, I'm a LinkedIn influencer, so I've got a couple hundred thousand people following me on that. And on a monthly basis, I write about current research or interesting cases that I've come across. And the comments that those things brought are quite interesting, I find. And finally, after years of teaching in the classroom, I've developed on the Harvard Business School HBX platform something called Negotiation Mastery, which is a full-fledged, highly interactive course, and people might take a look at that and see whether it would add something to their value. So if you search for HBX Negotiation Mastery up, it will pop and people can make a judgment. But there's a lot of material out there that doesn't have my name on it that can be useful, and I think, as I said just earlier, even modest learning can produce big payoffs.
Perfect. And for the listeners, as always, I will be linking out to all of the resources that Mike is talking about, and I will make them available in the show notes on the website. So if you need to access those, a quick, easy link can be found in the show notes if you just scroll down. And yeah, what an amazing pleasure it's been talking with you about this, Mike. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you, Mark, for the invitation, and keep up the great work.
Yeah, thanks, man. I really appreciate it. It was certainly a great pleasure. Hopefully, I can get you on again sometime soon.
Looking forward to hearing from you.
Hey, friends. Thanks so much for listening to this episode. If you enjoyed it, please share it with friends and colleagues so that they can benefit from it as well. If you find Negotiations Ninja Podcast worthy, please go on to iTunes and give us a cool rating with a nice review. We certainly appreciate every single one that we get because it helps us to understand who is listening, how they're listening, and what it is they like. If there's something that you would like me to discuss around negotiation, influence, or persuasion, give me a shout. You know how to reach me on social media, or you can get me on my website, which is www.negotiations.ninja.